You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. OneOfUs.net and all of the shows on it are 100% subscriber supported. Please consider becoming a subscriber to OneOfUs.net. Keep the site and all of our great shows going and get some terrific bonus content as well.
Okay, guys, I have a perfect way to pitch this. I have a perfect way to pitch this show to the fucking networks. Imagine if Criminal Minds wasn't the most boring show in the world, and we had people with charisma and actual like acting ability on the show. And let's just do Criminal Minds again.
I don't know. It seems like a lot of people sitting in a room talking to me, Alan. That seems too boring for the average viewer.
No. We get two people, one of which is probably the most boring person in the world, but then the other person just talks shit to him consistently, and it's great.
It's like a talk show, only with serial killers.
Exactly. My next guest tonight has murdered 10 people by pulling their entrails out.
And they're going to hunt them down across the city and spear into their minds. I need a good name for it, though.
Minds hunting, hunter of minds, talking. Brain
Ghost
searcher.
Hunters.
I don't know. I'm sure there's a better title somewhere.
There does seem to be a theme of, like, mind as a word, like criminal minds, mind hunter. Terminology. What is it about the mind? Yeah.
Exactly.
Nah, anyways.
Hey, everybody. It's a terrible thing to waste.
Anyway, this is Mindhunter Season 2. I know most of us here are super, super excited because, I mean, admittedly, I was slow to the game with Mindhunter. I actually had to have my wife here get me caught up because I know she is a humongous diehard fan of this show, which... Why? This seems like the least thing that, this seems like not up your alley.
What are you talking about? You don't like hearing how a man dismembered his own mother's head and fucked the corpse? This is great.
Well, I feel like I have a few reasons behind why I might like it. I mean, generally when I was growing up, my dad and I would watch, like, police procedural shows. Plus, I did grow up knowing that my grandfather was actually in the FBI. So I feel like I've always kind of had, like, an interest in, like, police... procedural stuff and, you know, fighting criminals and things like that. And so watching something like this and also seeing how intelligent it is, an intelligent show, it was just so exciting to watch it and be like, oh, this is just a breath of fresh air for, like, shows like this.
Yeah. This is a David Fincher produced series, and anytime you're reviewing any David Fincher project, we are contractually obligated to at least use the word cerebral once.
Yeah.
I just did.
Yeah, and also make sure that there's no proper lighting in the entire show. Everything black kind of looks like it's dark.
Well, we actually
all times.
There's some thoughts about that we'll have to address. But anyways, yeah. Just quick introductions. I'm Justin Zarian, like I mentioned. Over here is my lovely wife, Lexi.
Hello.
Yes, indeed. Over here, as you heard, there's Alan.
Hello, I'm here also.
And back again. Hey, we missed you, man. Marco.
Hey, I'm back again. It's, they just let me out of prison. Everything you've heard was wrong and a lie. I never murdered those people.
Yeah, we came down to visit you in Austin and interview you, Marco. Just we got 1 hour. You ready?
Yes, 1 hour. That's when they let me back in the yard. Okay.
Yo.
Oh, brother. So, Alan, why don't you give us a quick summary here? Like, just what's the basic setup for season two leading in from season one?
Okay, so, yeah, for people that have watched season one, the very basic setup for season one is we're trying to set up the behavioral science unit in the FBI. So, basically, we want to start setting criminal profiles because up until now, we've just been solving serial killers or anything like that just by, hey, where's the evidence? How are we going to find this guy? You know, what do you find connecting? And criminals have just been people just committing crimes of passion and crimes of opportunity. So season one is like, well, they're actually a new breed of serial killers, the people that actually plan this shit out more methodically and do it multiple times. So that basically gets set up very successfully in season one. And season two comes in like the fucking, like Nick Fury from the Avengers comes in and goes, hey, man, I'm going to give you all this money. We're going to make this the tip of the fucking FBI. We're going to give you everything you need in order to make sure that this is now a viable, like, option. It feels like they're jumpstarting it. So I keep forgetting the actor's name, but he played Professor Pig.
Michael Cerveris. Yeah, he comes in like white incredible. Nick Fury. He's just like, you thought you were the only criminal scientist here.
Mindhunters assemble.
And you think, because when they talk about it, like, oh, he's a DC suit, he's going to stop this. Like, no. He comes in and goes, hey, what do you guys need? You guys need money? Okay, I got you money. You guys need people? I got you people. You need a big place? I got you a big place. just do your fucking job. I'm like, okay, cool. They're giving them the room to breathe that they desperately didn't get in season one and actually believe in that. So it's like, yeah, the entire premise of season one is, okay, we have the foundation to start working. Now we're actually going to start applying it. And that's probably the most important thing. Can we actually apply this and make it work? So that's the premise of season two.
Now, yeah. It literally picks up like almost the minute after season one ends, more or less. Like, I was kind of surprised when I saw that first episode. I'm just like, oh. I guess Holt's still, Holden. He's still in that psychiatric hospital where after just seeing Ed Kemper. So,
yeah, much, there's yeah. definitely a. The first three episodes, which are the only ones directed by David Fincher, which means they're the best directed episodes of the season.
Yeah, that's fair.
They actually clean up a whole lot of loose dangling threads from the end of season one, which I kind of appreciated, but a lot of those things kind of get dropped. A lot of those first episodes feel like, all right, here's who everybody is. Here's what the state of the investigation is. That's a way, you know, we're getting rid of Holden's panic attack issues. Well, here's what's going on with Bill. It's really kind of stage setting. And as Alan said, in the previous season, we saw these guys going out on the road, interviewing serial killers, and then informally consulting with local investigations and applying some of the things they learned from those serial killers to help nab fictional criminals based on the insights gleaned from the real criminals. However, in this one, they can't do that anymore. These guys are no longer on the road. They've got an organization behind them, and now it's time to put it to the test. And in real life, one of the big first high-profile jobs assigned to the BSU was the shitstorm that was the Atlanta child murders. And that is really the meat of season two. You still have some of the, let's go visit Charles Manson or Son of Sam. But about a quarter of the way into the story, they just go, we're in Atlanta. And that is some of the best and worst aspects of season two. In my opinion.
And it's really fascinating, too, because for those of you who don't know, Mindhunter is based on the actual book by John Douglas. And I've been reading the book, and it's super fascinating because the Atlanta murders, the actual John Douglas,
That's the one that's Holden's character, right?
Holden, yeah, I'm sorry.
Loosely based on.
Yeah, Holden.
We have a Bradley. She read the book prior.
I married a Bradley. That's scary.
I know. But yeah, Holden's character is based on the real John Douglas, and he was one of the actual FBI agents who was there during the actual Atlanta murders. And, you know, the real Atlanta killings were just so awful. And so it was kind of interesting to see that they really did heavily focus in on that. Because it's just such a fascinating yet really disturbing and so sad series of cases, really. Well,
and I will say that's one of the things, you know, again, I can't fully review this fairly because I did miss some episodes due to work and as such. But from the stuff I did see, one of the things I did like was that adding the Atlanta child murders as a recurring plot thing actually gave the season a little bit more momentum because first season, it's a little slow. It's very talky. It's very methodical. It's almost more Zodiac than it is any other David Fincher films.
Well, you got to understand is what they're going for the two seasons are very drastically different.
Yes. Yeah.
Because they knew to a certain degree that they were going to get multiple seasons, especially in this one. They knew for a fact that they were going to get a multiple time to tell a story, which is why, again, you always have the normal stuff you see in a television show of we need to develop the personalities of the characters so that you can grow to like them. Wendy, for instance, like you get to know her background. You get to know Bill's background with his kid and stuff like that. It's like, so you get to know the kids, the typical show stuff. But again, the first season was like, we need you to understand that this show is going to be 100% three people in a room talking and them trying to break them down psychologically like they do in typical like interview fashion. Because you see Holden's, because he was a negotiator in the first episode, and he knows how to kind of break people down, how to figure out like, well, is this person egotistical? Let me play to their egos. Is this person very shy? Let me see if I can play that. Is this person like weird as hell and I'm gonna say eight ripe cunts to him and he's gonna chill with me like he's my bro? He's able to break it down where again, Bill is the typical FBI person, so he comes in kind of as a hard ass to bounce off each other. That's most of what the show is. But it's, with season two, you have to kind of change it up a little bit. But it's still the same kind of idea of we got to find what the fuck's going on through these psychological means. And one of my favorite things about season two is a lot of the stuff you always hear, like, that were cliches at this point, because, again, just like Lexi, I love police procedurals as a kid. I watched them all the fucking time until I could tell the killer in the first 5 minutes and I stopped watching. Yeah. They're all the fucking same. It's right before the first commercial break, and it's usually someone you meet right as soon as they talk.
Like, it's usually the guest star of the show.
Yeah. Or the secretary. It's always the secretary.
Or David Ogden Steers. It's always David Ogden Steers.
But one of the things that threw me out was a lot of the terms they would use. Oh, he always goes back to the scene of the crime. He always does this, blah, blah. Those are such cliche things, but imagine being in the 70s and hearing that shit for the first time. Like, what do you mean they go back to the scene of the crime? That sounds like the stupidest thing in the fucking world. But it's like, this is stuff that happens. And to me, the back half of the season with the Atlanta stuff felt like Narcos Mexico, where it's so, like, dense. Every episode is so dense, but it's so interesting because it's like watching a book unfold.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and there's just so much to cover within, like, the Atlanta arc especially. Like, there's just, like, it's like they're trying to cram everything into it, you know, like, oh, there was this thing happening, there's this thing happening, and all this other stuff.
Well, and not just the actual events, but all the racial politics too about it. Because that was admittedly one of those things that it's so tricky to navigate, especially because, you know, like with a lot of things dealing with the season, there's no good answers to what the outcome may be for this Atlanta Child Murders. Either it is what the public wants it to be, or it is the truth of what it may actually have been, or maybe that isn't even true. It's just such a mess.
It's one of the reasons why I liked season one so much, because it was kind of like the old Route 66 TV show, only with, you know, criminal profilers, where they'd go into a new town, they'd have a little adventure, and you had that resolution. They're like, we caught the guy, or, you know, we broke through, you know, this crazed person. We finally gleaned some insight. So every episode, you kind of had some resolution there. Once you get to Atlanta, and they're kind of bound by the real facts of the case, you realize very quickly, as Holden and Tench do, that they're not really free to do their jobs. There's a whole lot of politics involved. There's a lot of very well understood mistrust between the authorities and the Atlanta black community, who are convinced this is the Klan doing it. You've got a new black mayor who's trying to deal with urban white flight that's depleting the tax base, and a brand new, you know, airport that's going to transform Atlanta into a major hub. Nowadays, we think of Atlanta as this major metropolitan center, but this was a moment in time when Atlanta was trying to really become what it is today. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Having a child murderer running around is bad for business and does not make it a good place for investment dollars.
I would never would have thought that.
And so, yeah, they're kind of hamstrung by this. And as they find out that the local authorities aren't doing a very good job, and
they're kind of where
it drags, because we're used to the guys doing something, and now they're stuck in this quagmire. And instead of handling a bunch of little cases back and forth, they're really stuck on one case and not getting a lot of traction. And meanwhile, Wendy and Greg are back at Quantico, and the more they stay stuck in Atlanta, the less we see of those other characters. I think this was actually not the best season for Anna Toff, because Dr. Wendy Carr is a great character, and about two-thirds of the season, she kind of disappears.
Because she just... you bring up Greg, and you bring up Greg Wendy. They were, to me, the most, like, honestly, filler of this entire fucking season. Because, like, you deal with Greg, and he's basically dealing with the consequences of season one, where... I don't know if that's a spoiler, but basically he does some stuff in season one and to deal with the consequences, where they essentially just write him out. They're like, you know what? We don't even want to deal with you. As far as you're concerned, you're not one of us. Like, they basically all but tell him you've been banished. And it's like, okay, that's kind of like, maybe he's going to redeem himself. Maybe he's going to do his job. Like, no. And then Wendy just has the exact same character arc from the start. She just kind of sits back and does her psychologically, going, well, this is how you feel, and this is how I feel. That's her entire thing the entire time. I'm like, you are so dreadfully dull this season that I don't want to see you anymore. So, like, episode four is, like, the weakest because it almost entirely focuses on them, too. I'm like, no. Get back to what makes this show good. This is Bill and Holden's fucking show. Get back to them. So when it basically forgets about Greg and Wendy, it does become a better show. But I'll give you this. It's definitely the worst season for those two characters, because it feels like they had no idea what to do with them.
Yeah, well, that's part of the thing, is that it's not any fault on Anna Torv of why Wendy was maybe a little weaker this season. Because I thought her acting-wise, she's great in this show.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, would you agree with that,
Ann? Yeah, because I think they were really just trying to focus on the Atlanta storyline. And because of that, so many things just got sidelined. As you said, like the... anxiety storyline for Holden, and And unfortunately, yeah,
they pretty much addressed that like almost the first two episodes. Just
I thought it was going to be like something you'd see throughout the whole season, and instead we ended up getting a bit more of Bill Tench, and like they did give Anna Torv a lot more to do, sort of. But the problem is, it wasn't as interesting as the other storylines, like the Atlanta one.
Compared to the Atlanta storyline, which is so riveting and complicated and intense, watching Anna Torv deal with her relationship problems was just.
Does it matter?
Yeah, no, especially the way it ends, you're just like, oh, well.
Yeah, it does feel like, what was that all about, even? It was unsatisfying for her, and that's too bad. But, you know, for me, I kind of had the opposite feeling, because I've recently, you know, did some research on the Atlanta child murders by complete coincidence. I read these John Douglas books like 20 years ago, and it kind of put me off serial killers for a while. But if you're interested in the real story, I highly recommend, I think it's iHeartRadio has put out a Monster Atlanta. It's a great deep dive into this, and we interview the guy who was accused of being the killer, Wayne Williams, as well as John Douglas himself. And you get a lot of the nitty gritty, and a lot of those elements come out in this show. And that was where I was like, you know, I already know where this is going, and I resent the time we're stuck with it, because there's one point where they, I won't spoil anything, but they catch a suspect. And in the podcast, at least in the true history, it's kind of a darkly comic footnote in the investigation, but they give almost an entire episode. And I'm sitting there going, I know this isn't the guy. I know what the joke this is building up to. Can we just move on, please?
Well, the problem,
okay, but that's the thing, though.
But not that's everyone's going to know that.
That's actually a really interesting thing, which is why I, prior to the recording, I yelled at Justin and said, let's spoil everything for him, because he does that. There are
no didn't spoil anything, okay? I'm not saying anything. I'm keeping
I'm never
quiet.
Forgiving you for secret sessions. What the fuck? The official secrets, or whatever the fuck that shit
you, movie you will see it, people. I have edited out the spoilers.
But there is a situation in which people don't necessarily know the actual, like, they don't know the history, even though that this is real life history. Not a lot of people know this. To me, I honestly had to stop myself from looking up who the killer for the Atlanta murderers, because I'm like, is it him? I don't want to spoil myself, because this is based on real life stuff. So it's like, you have to balance it around people that have never read the book, don't even know who the hell John Douglas is, and don't look this stuff up. And I think the show does a pretty good job of balancing it, because, again, it feels like watching Narcos. This is like, they're like, hey, you know, Narcos Mexico is an incredibly dense show. Let's kind of take the style they did with that to focus on it, because when you do with the Atlanta murders, they are bogged down by red tape, because there's a hilarious episode where they're trying to get crosses and then flyers for the fucking thing. Which made me at one point, if I was there, I would gotta fight somebody. Literally, I'm like, you know what? Oh, you're not getting my fucking flyers? I will fight you. I'm like, how did you maintain your composure? But yeah, there is.
But that also leads to the worst directed sequence in the entire season. That
I'm curious, what do you mean by that?
Huh?
Well, I'm curious what you mean by that.
Well, again, I don't want to spoil too much. This was most, we should say that half of this season almost, I think 4 of the 9 episodes were directed by Carl Franklin, who is a fascinating guy and definitely a fine director.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Not David Fincher. He's not a David Fincher type. He has his own style, and I don't think his style and Fincher's always meshes. And there's one particular sequence. It almost feels like they're so bogged down. The writers were like, you know what? We need to add some suspense. Let's introduce a low stakes race against time for up some suspense.
Oh yeah, that scene. I know.
And it doesn't have any narrative or emotional payoff. And halfway through, there's a subtle change to the film stock, let's say. And I know what they were trying to accomplish, but it's almost subtle enough not to notice. And frankly, the more you think about the geography and logistics of the scene, you realize how ludicrous it is, because that means the killer is in Holden's face a few yards away filming him the whole time. And that's exactly why Holden was there, to flush the guy out. I'm like, you didn't notice the guy chasing you down each back alley as you try to get to the head of the line? It just seemed a little silly to me, and it just felt like, well, let's throw some suspense in here, because nothing really exciting has happened, so let's have a little foot race.
I don't get there trying to throw suspense. I think they're like, oh man, two detectives exists. Let's pull a true detective.
Yeah, but I mean, to me, I kept thinking, if David Fincher shot that, it would be kind of subtly terrifying, because you'd realize that somebody's watching Holden. And I kind of felt like that's what they were going with. But they didn't really do much with it. And it's, you know, it's kind of a dull spot in what's otherwise a pretty good episode. And again, we haven't really talked about the directing too much on this, but my goodness, Fincher can make anything interesting and terrifying. I mean, look, any TV show that starts off with Roxy Music's, you know, In Every Dream Home, A Heartache, and then ends with The Overload by Talking Heads already has me pegged, right? You got me. You've got me, show. But at some point, you know, Franklin comes in. There's also a another fine director, and I'm blanking on his.
Andrew Dominik.
Yeah, they all do good jobs, but it doesn't really feel like Mindhunter to me as much. But I do agree that Carl Franklin was the perfect choice for the last half of this season because it requires a certain sensitivity when you're going into a black community that historically has had all these issues. And I think even David Fincher probably knows that his cold, clinical, dispassionate approach probably not the right fit for those scenes.
Probably not.
Because David Fincher thinks everyone's equally worthless.
Well, that's the thing, too, is that it's funny you say that he doesn't know Fincher's style, because Carl Franklin actually did work on House of Cards for a long time,
Yeah,
so you think that he would be more familiar, but I do agree that that particular sequence you mentioned is jarring because it's so visually unlike anything else in the show, which...
Right. Maybe that's why it stood out so much to me.
Well, it's visually... It's weird because, like, watching it, I wasn't quite sure what the point was.
Exactly.
Because he's running through, and it's like... I get that he has to get across a certain point, but I failed to get grasp the significance within the sequence where it's like, why is this such a big deal? Like, I get, like, what was going on prior. Like, the actual sequence itself, and I kind of agree with Michael, like, it's not really well done because it's unclear the goal. It's unclear the motive.
The goal was to flush out the killer. And the killer
was supposed... why would the cross be that necessary, though?
Because it was the... All right. This was the reason for it in the show, was that... Holden, based on what they gleaned from some of these other serial killers, including Kemper, was like, hey, these guys like to return to the scene of the crime. Also, he suspected, as the real-life Wayne Williams was doing, was following the story very closely in the media. So he said, why don't we put these little temporary vigils in key locations that are important to the investigation, places where bodies were found. Then he convinces the grieving mothers to change the route of the march so that they walk in front of these places. And the belief was that, you know, the killer would somewhere be in the crowd. They could start looking around and maybe start identifying some people who might be leads. The problem is, at some point, it's very clear that Holden is being observed, and the real Wayne Williams did, in fact, work on occasionally as a freelance photographer and cameraman who sold footage to the TV shows in Atlanta, to the news shows. So when you see Holden being observed from through a camera, you go, oh, it worked. He flushed him out. The thing is, Holden doesn't know it, and the killer isn't where he would be. How was the killer doesn't even know who Holden is at this point, so why is he just hanging out in an alleyway waiting for an FBI guy with a cross to run by? It totally undercut the purpose of the scene. But you see, again, I had to work at it to kind of construct in my mind what was supposed to be happening.
I thought
there.
They just did the fucking weird twist just to be cool. Like, I didn't even, again, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's such a confusing sequence that felt so out of place for the show. I'm like, whatever, you're trying to do a true detective thing.
It was just, you know, there was a good idea in there, and I think someone like Fincher would have nailed it. I just don't think that's the kind of games that Franklin is up to. I think he's a much more direct, much more emotional character-based type actor, and he manages to keep all of those black characters in that scene at all times. Even when they're in the background, I think in a Fincher film they might feel like background detail, whereas the way Franklin photographs them, it makes them feel like part of that story more than I think Fincher's approach would have. So he's the right choice for it. But not for that particular sequence.
Yeah. Well, not to just dwell completely on that one scene.
Yes,
there's nine episodes of show here.
There's nine episodes of show.
That's the thing that nine episodes, I think it's a reasonably paced season from the stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I guess you probably agree with that. But something Lexi pointed out, too, when we talk about the visual style, it's weirdly, like, you can tell sometimes when the directors shift because... Like we said, sometimes there'll be stuff like Franklin's stuff there with the chase sequence, but there's some other shots of stuff they would show with, like, Anna Torres' character, where I don't know if this is truly how it looked or not, but sometimes the lighting was so strong you could see the makeup lines around them, and it was, like, really jarring.
Yeah, because, like, you know, if you look at most of the season, it's kind of, like, yellowish-toned a little bit, and you know, and some people pointed out that, you know, they're not, I'm not quite sure if it was like a little bit of the lighting and makeup, or it was just the lighting and it made the makeup stand out a little bit more. But there were some shots where it looked like some of them are a little bit more jaundiced looking than they should have been. I was like, I'm not sure if like it was just like it just looks so weird in some shots. Like most of it was fine, but there were a few times where I was like, this looks just kind of off.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, there are some shots I thought that worked really well. One sequence I saw with Lexi that I thought was one of my favorite bits, there's a whole situation where Bill is interviewing a guy in a truck.
Yes.
And the way that sequence is shot
is
just really smart filmmaking techniques.
Oh, yeah.
David Fincher.
That's
the best directed scene in the series.
I would agree.
And it's all Fincher.
Yeah, no, that's pretty amazing work he did there. And it's so subtle, too. Like you said, like, it's just a little bit of blurring in the shot and a little bit of positioning in the angles and stuff. And it's not showy, it's not flashy, but it's just so effective.
Yeah, it's just really riveting. Yeah, just the way it was shot and the way it was acted. Everybody did a really good job. You know, even the guy, we don't see him, like, that's like his only scene in the whole show. And he did a great job. And it was one of my favorite scenes, honestly, in the whole show, along with some stuff in episode 5.
Well, because to talk about a few of the other things that happened in this show, they of course have to bring back Ed Kemper for one single scene in this whole show, which was nice to see him again.
Yeah, although they never acknowledge his last meeting with Holden. I'm like, shouldn't there have been a moment like, hey, dude, we okay? We cool? I mean, you remember what happened?
Oh no, Ed is totally cool. You can't. He says, hey, you came to visit me. Hi, you're my best friend.
I've completely forgotten about that panic attack I had an episode ago.
Yeah. No, but there was a great bit that followed right after that where they, you know, everyone talked about this because this dude was cast in two things as the exact same role. But,
man.
Yeah. Damon Harriman showing up as Charlie Manson again after Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I don't know how you guys thought about this. I don't even think it's the best sequence in the whole show, but I couldn't stop laughing during that whole bit.
It was an incredible character. It was an incredible character portrayal that I think is second to none, but utterly unnecessary for the show. Because when you actually, Ed Kemper's one line was way more relevant to the plot of the show than anything Manson said, because Manson was just the entire point of Manson's interview that influenced the show was to basically have Bill's character, Bill Tedge's character, start to slowly lose his fucking mind. Because he's hearing this shit and might as well be talking to him. And he's not talking to the microphone. He's literally talking to him. He's like, yeah, I know your son is fucking nuts. Like, he is taking it all, and you see how it's starting to make him explode. So it's like, it's not, and that's what I get from. Like, no, don't sit there and get the most infamous people. Get the people no one's ever fucking heard of, so you can do more interesting stuff with them. Because I prefer when shows do that. What's up?
Well, the infamous people that's kind of the big draw, isn't it? I mean, it's like we got Son of Sam.
I know, but they did good stuff without the infamy. That's why I don't like when shows do that, where it's like we're able to do really good stuff with people you don't know of, but now that we're popular, we have to do popular.
No, but
I hate that obligation.
Real Douglas did interview Manson, and he wanted to. You know, even though Wendy's like, why are we interviewing this guy? He's not even a real serial killer. Yeah. But, you know, it's definitely, I think Alan is right in that it's there to kind of create that generational divide, a crazy guy like Manson who's anti-establishment and throwing the sicknesses of the next generation, putting all that at the blame of the parents, notably Bill, basically saying, your kid's fucked up and you're the reason why.
You know,
I just let them do whatever they want, but you're the reason your kids are fucked up. And as we haven't even talked about Bull's subplot this season with his... I guess his child is autistic. It probably wasn't very well understood at the time. He has some kind of borderline. He's definitely on the spectrum.
Yeah, he's definitely like antisocial, like autistic behavior kind of thing.
And some bad
things
happen.
Looking like the kid from Brightburn.
Yeah, some bad things happen revolving that kid, and it really drives a wedge between Bill and his wife. And he's stuck in Atlanta and then having to go back every Friday to be there for child parent counseling and then still go back, and he's like, I'm working 65 hours a week and going back and forth between Atlanta and Georgia or Virginia. You see Bill, who's been kind of the rock of the group, you see how he starts to crumble, how it starts to take a toll on him emotionally, physically, mentally. Just as Holden's kind of starting to get his shit together, we see Bill start to fall apart. And that's an interesting dichotomy, because that oddball, odd couple pairing, I think that's the heart of the show for me, is Bill and Holden.
Yeah, no, and I think actually making Bill one of the more predominant characters this season was a really good choice, because I like Holden enough, but I think Holt McCallany as Bill, he just has such gravitas to the role, you know? Yeah. Like he's a good straight man for a type of show like this. Yeah, and he had some of the best burns and one-liners throughout this whole show, too. Like,
oh, 100%.
Yeah, like, I won't spoil too much, but like I said, for the Manson scene, a bunch of stuff that he says to Manson, I couldn't stop laughing. I was just like, that is perfect.
Well,
the
way what this show gets, and I was talking about this with one of our other reviewers, Frank Calvillo, when we went to review Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which also has the same guy playing Manson.
Yep.
Not that you'd notice, because he's playing him in slightly different eras. But when we were kids in the early 70s, Manson had only been in prison for, you know, less than a decade, maybe 5 or 6 years. I don't know. He was the boogeyman. He was terrifying. He was genuinely a source of fear. And the movies that did portray him treated him as this sort of messianic, charismatic, terrifying figure. What Douglas kind of figures out, and you see it in this show, and also what I think Tarantino figures out and in his film, is that Manson's an idiot. He's a lunatic, a somewhat charismatic, effective lunatic that has managed to convince a bunch of drug, dim-witted hippie kids to do heinous shit. And it's like, oh my God, why did we put them on that pedestal? Manson lived long enough to kind of basically become a punchline. Oddly admired, there's a strange cult of personality that has developed around him over the years that he certainly never deserved. But I think I think over the years we've realized just how shallow and empty of a character Manson was. And you get that. You see, even though it's unnerving to Bill just sees this stupid, dirty hippie who's like a waste of his time. And I think that's only Holden would be really interested in a guy like Manson.
Well, it's funny, too, because we talk about why would we interview Manson for the infamous stuff. The times they show the minor serial killers in here, they're just like, oh, yeah, there's a reason why we don't interview these guys, because they're stupid and insane, too.
Oh, that was great, though.
Dude, those are my favorite ones.
Well, because like you see Holden bored.
That's my favorite one. Like the dude that likes the candy.
Yeah.
Is like one of my favorite things. I'm like, you are fucking hilariously stupid. It is great.
Yeah, but it's also a great time for the new cast member. Albert Jones is Jim Barney.
Oh, yeah.
Best new addition. You see Barney in season one briefly. He applies for Greg's job, and everyone's like, Bill and Wendy are like, yeah, this guy's great. We should make him part of the team. And Holden's like, nope, most of our interview subjects are fucking racist. So the minute we bring this guy in, they're never going to open up to him. And what we find out is sitting right next to him is like, actually, he's really good at getting through these guys. And Holden is bored. And you see Barney like, well, I guess I'm the one who's going to have to lead this interview because this guy's not doing anything.
Because again, because Holden likes, that's what I like about the show and why I like that the heart of the show is Bill and Holden's his relationship. Because like they walk into the room and it's like it's filmed like Iron Man and Tony Stark just walked into the fucking room to talk about Dick Fury. And I fucking love it. Like I screen capped it. I've been making memes because like them walking in is the heart and soul of the show. But they need to bounce off of each other. If they're not in the same room with each other, they can't seem to do their jobs properly. Right. And that's one of the big conflicts is you can tell that this relationship is straining on them to the extent where they're almost about to start having a screaming match halfway through.
They are kind of an old married couple at this point.
Yeah.
But which is why it's great to have Barney as a new fresh character who isn't burned out yet the way they are.
Yeah, I mean, and Barney's not directly based on any real person, but he's a fun little amalgam of all the people they've worked with. But I mean, Lexi, any other points you wanted to bring up for... you've been a little quiet over here.
Oh,
oh I'm sorry.
No. Oh, no, it's all good. Because, there was just so many things I really enjoyed, like, for this season. And I actually thought that the Manson stuff was rather interesting because the thing of Manson is he never directly killed anybody. And so that was kind of why I think they were probably a bit... fascinated with him in a way, and plus they followed the Manson interview up with the interview of Tex Watson, which I thought was actually kind of interesting. Holden, you know, just interviews them one-on-one, and they discuss it, and it's, you know, he tries to get some insight onto a guy who was basically brainwashed by Manson.
And you definitely get a sense that the show doesn't think very highly of Tex Watson either. They're like, this guy's just a sheep. Nope. He's just looking for something to follow.
Exactly.
Which is, again, this is the... I think Wendy has perhaps the best line in the series, or the season, which is when she's warning Holden not to get too close to these guys. They're not to be admired. They're not...
A little late for that time.
And, you know, she says, and you shouldn't empathize with them too much. She says, every time you empathize with a serial killer, you negate some of your own humanity. And that's something that Holden is going to have to learn the hard way.
Yeah, it's almost like he's the what's his name? The main character from Hannibal, the kind of way, where he's becoming that guy over the course of the
story. Who is also based on John Douglas.
Well, there you go, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was all of that stuff that Thomas Harris is based on his work directly with John Douglas. And he kind of is the reason why we got this glut after the hit that was Silence of the Lambs. We got this glut of movies that romanticize serial killers. Everybody suddenly had to be Hannibal Lecter. They had to be smart and sexy and have unlimited funds and be aesthetes and, you know, devise these elaborate ways of killing people. And Mindhunter is a refreshing way of getting back to the basics, going, no, actually... most of these guys are really grubby pieces of shit that aren't worth knowing.
Oh, yeah. It is.
But they're infamous and they're dangerous and we need to study them.
Yeah, no, the one that got to me for the grubby pieces of crap like that, it was Stan Berkowitz when they interviewed him, where I'm just like, oh, yeah, this dude was just some lunatic who decided, you know what, I'm bored. I'm just going to start killing people. And then I'm going to tell people demons did it.
Yeah, I watched The Exorcist. They'll believe that.
No, I definitely love that story where he breaks them down, because it's like, yeah, it's something that I've always been not as fascinated as other people are serial killers, but serial killers is something that's always been interesting to me, because it's always a puzzle of always trying to solve. Like,
I'm keeping my eye on you, Alan. I gotta be worried about that.
No, because it's always a very interesting idea, because like, we're so used to it's always this fallacy that we see in media of what the quote unquote criminal is, when you realize 99% of crimes are just people that are in poor destitute situations just trying to get by. That's what most crimes are. So when you're seeing somebody that's actively going out of their way to commit crimes and planning it out, it's always interesting, because you're trying to solve the psychological puzzle that has no real answers. It's a Rubik's Cube and you're blind. So it's like, how the fuck are you going to solve this? So I always found this stuff interesting.
It's like
watching the show.
If you read the Douglas books, they get very depressing very quickly, because the majority...
I'm sure they do.
Not only is it horrific, but the majority of the... It's a depressingly predictable set of circumstance, like usually born in poverty, you know, single parent, usually abusive parents, wetting the bed, playing with arson at an early age, torturing animals, usually some kind of crippling insecurity and sexual hangups. It becomes like this recipe for serial killers, and they're so, you know, all of these guys are kind of fucked up in predictable ways. And I love the fact that the show is kind of starting to suggest that, rather than a source of fascination, these guys are basically the broken models. And one of the results of criminal profiling was that, you know, we can detect those backgrounds and predict whether this person is going to go bad or not, to a certain degree. And it also says, don't glamorize these guys. Don't be too fascinated. They're broken pieces of shit. You're basically fascinated with a defective car. It's no different than anything else. It's just, it hit a few bumps and that crack along the chassis finally broke through, and now you're in a death trap. But it's not, they're not inherently interesting.
But Ed Kemper has my second favorite line of the entire series of, is everything you glean from serial killers just the people you caught?
Yeah.
That's the entire premise of the back half of these dudes. Like, every single thing that they learned about serial killers are people that they've caught.
Which ties into BTK.
Exactly, which ties it to what happened with the land murders, where Holden has no fucking idea, because it's like, wait a second, nobody I'm interviewing here fits my fucking profile. Right. So how am I supposed to adjust that? I can't wait for them to adjust that in season three of like, how that I got to change almost my entire like approach to this, because there are new breeds that are always happening and they're learning. They're learning our techniques.
Yeah, Holden's definitely becoming arrogant and complacent, and something's had to rattle that for him to evolve.
Yeah.
Well, that's at his best, is when he's arrogant, is like when he thinks he is untouchable. Which, again, my favorite line of the entire series is when the old FBI director goes, what are you, the fucking thought police?
After 27 years, you're the reason I'm leaving, you know. Oh man, that was almost worth it. That character has a great ending.
Because usually everyone kind of deals with Holden. This is the first time you just straight see someone go, "Fuck you, bitch!"
Yeah, that scene made me laugh. Hates
Holden. Well, because I think at that moment, we as the audience want it. Everyone's like, "Jesus Christ, this someone needs to bring this guy down a peg or two."
A little bit, yeah.
It's like on the one hand, you feel a little bit bad for him because you're like, "Oh, I wouldn't want to be in that situation if it was me," but at the same time, you're like, but he kind of deserved it because of all the crap from season one. It just kind of piled on top finally. And the guy, he just snapped. He's just like, no, I don't like you.
Yeah. You have no idea of the wreckage you create around you. And then he was like, my God, you really are a pussy. I mean, you just needed to see someone who isn't Bill or Wendy knock Holden back. Or knock him down because he needs it. He needs a couple kicks in his ass. And I think Atlanta starts to give him maybe the little push he needs because he realizes that he's not always going to be the golden boy and he's not always going to be able to walk into the room and solve everything. There are realities that he has to deal with, messy realities like people and grieving mothers and, you know, shifty politicians.
And fucking tape.
Red tape, corrupt cops, you know. I mean,
incompetent
cops, and some of whom are actually members of the fucking Ku Klux Klan. So, I mean, it's not the best situation.
Yeah, yes. In fact, there's definitely a few scenes in there where they heavily imply that there may have been some, like, evidence tampering plus just huge blunders by the police in general. Like, they have one scene where they're like, oh, we need you to, like, collect this evidence. And then they go back to the officers and they're like, did you collect it? And he's like, no, you just told me to write stuff down. They're like, we just assumed that you would do your job.
Collect evidence.
I rewound that just to make sure. And he's like, log everything. Yes, sir. And he's like, and he logs everything, but he doesn't actually take it.
Well, because you gotta understand is that this is a new, like, because they established this in season one where nobody really understands it because this is a new breed of criminal. Yeah. This is a new breed of how we're going to actually start dealing with this stuff. So they're like, wait, we just stopped this guy because he was out on the road at 3 a.m. because someone kind of heard a splash. So you want me to do what?
Which we don't really get this kind of stuff yet. Day, whether or not that actually happened. But yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It does not. I think the show gives you, and I won't spoil anything, but I think the show does give you, it gives you a suspect. You can read up on the history, but I don't think it makes a decision. I think Holden makes a decision, but I as to who's guilty. But I do think it leaves some ambiguity in the air for you to appreciate.
Well, yeah, there's a reason to believe that maybe it could be one thing or another. And even then, it's like Holden explained at some points, like, look, I don't think that it's all, like, everything is to blame on this person, but it seems very likely there's a bunch of them that is to blame with this person. And so that's the thing where it gives you a little bit of leeway to go one way or the other with it.
Yeah, in fact, well, the real life case, they've actually, as recently as a few years ago, and
like a few months ago.
Oh, yeah, and as of a few months ago, they've been reopening some of those cases to take another look again. Just, you know, they want to be really sure that they may have caught the real guy and or if they didn't, to see if they can catch the actual real person, but I do agree that they do leave a lot of ambiguity in case, just in case maybe they did make a mistake, you know, because there are some people that really believe that they may have caught the wrong guy, and there's some people that really, really believe they did catch the right guy, and there's no way to 100% guarantee they ultimately did.
Which I'm sure Fincher looked back at Zodiac and said, yeah, I built a whole conspiracy theory on something that turned out to be false. So
literally, like, this ends like the Zodiac Killer movie, like, in the exact same way.
Well, at least he didn't make a big, like, oh, it was definitely this guy that get in Zodiac. Because it's like, oh, no, they disproved that almost immediately after the movie came out. So
they left it pretty wide open. I mean, that's also a big evolution in serial killer cinema, if we could even speak of it as a genre. You look at something that David Fincher does, Seven, you know, like really his first big hit.
Yep.
And it is Grand Guignol. You have the serial killer who's just got this elaborate methodology, you know, infinite resources all the time in the world to set these diabolical plans in motion. And then by the time you get to Zodiac and now Mindhunter, you really see how Fincher has gotten less flashy, less showy. A more mature Fincher seems to be more dealing with the ambiguities, keeping things kind of simple. And it's really fascinating to see how he's evolved from that first serial killer film to this one, because I think he's the best person we have right now working in this genre.
Yeah.
Well, because the joke I started off with, it's like Criminal Minds, but actually good, isn't just me making a joke. I fucking hate Criminal Minds. I think it's dreadfully dull. I tried to watch a season and I was bored to fucking tears. So I had to. So when season one came out and a friend of mine's like, it's like Criminal Minds, I didn't watch a show for like a good like 6 months because of that. Like, no. But imagine if it was good. I'm like, okay, I'll watch one episode. Okay, I'm in. Because you see that subtlety. You see them basically, again, it's like the interviews with the serial killer type stuff. You get the gleam into why they're doing it. And they're not treating them. Like, it's weird because as much as they are monsters, the interviews aren't treating them like monsters. They're just giving them a chance to voice, as crazy as they are, voice their thoughts. And that, to me, is interesting because I'm like, what is going on in your mind that you think that you're not doing something wrong? Or maybe you are doing something wrong and you don't give a crap. That's my favorite parts of the show.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've been going on for a while now with this review. Just to summarize a couple points before we lead into final thoughts. Just from the stuff I've seen, the makeup work and the costume they do to make people look like their real-life counterparts is pretty spot on.
It's incredible. Like, some people have been putting out, like, side-by-side comparisons of the, you know, the actors and the actual serial killers, and some of it's almost uncanny. It's incredible.
Ed Kemper looks exactly like that.
Yeah.
I don't think so. He's a lot chubbier.
He's
a lot chubbier than real Ed Kemper. But the guy who had Berkowitz, I mean, the makeup they did on him is amazing.
Oh yeah.
I still stand by that Manson looks more like Kat Dennings than the actor they got. By those words. What? He looks just like Kat Dennings. Look up a picture of Kat Dennings from back in the day and tell me what difference between him and Manson.
Can you imagine how much it sucks being known for looking like Charlie Manson? That guy's,
he looks
like,
just,
hey, man,
like him.
I love that you got booked me the gigs working with Fincher and Tarantino, but could you maybe find me some non-Manson-related work?
You know? Yeah. No, but otherwise, though, the production values are all really stellar, aside from a few quibbles we've mentioned about the lighting and the stylistic choices.
Oh.
The acting is, great across the board. Like, I don't think there's any bad actors really in this show at all. And
I go with Wendy, not to say she's bad, just very unnecessary. But if we're talking about something bad, something that really, really bothered me. So, okay, one of my favorite fucking Marvel movies ever is Civil War. And I love when they did the splash shot of whatever city they were. Queens, whatever the fuck.
Oh.
This tries to do it. Oh, my God. It's like mid-center, 1,500 words in this weird font. I'm like, I don't know where we are.
I love that. I was inordinately happy to see this huge wall of text every time.
But it was unclear.
Wichita, Kansas. It's
wasn't that clear. It would be like Atlanta, Georgia, and this street address. I'm like, I don't know where to look right now. I don't know where we are.
I don't know.
You couldn't read the lettering tells you where you are.
Because it attacked me. I felt attacked.
Well, aside from that, the only other thing I can mention is that we kind of hinted a little bit. They still keep doing the recurring backstory of the BTK killer, just in the cold opens and the outros for some of the episodes, which I'm glad they're still pursuing that and they've discussed that. I'm curious where that's going to go, because technically the BTK wasn't captured till 2004. So are they going to do like an ending thing at the very end where, like, and then we caught the BTK killer here or something like that, or I don't know.
Nah, they'll just push you out of the continent and solve it 20 years prior.
It's going to be a big time jump.
Probably. Yeah. But, I guess if we want to start going to the final thoughts, Lexi, do you want to start us off with a final thought there?
Oh, man, I have so many thoughts. But, well, overall, I think this is one of my favorite Netflix series, honestly. Like, right up there of Stranger Things, of course. Both are really, they're very different series, but I enjoy them both. But definitely Mindhunter. David Fincher, he did incredible first three episodes, and I actually was pretty impressed with Carl Franklin as a director for, the rest of the season. There was definitely a few hiccups here and there, as you mentioned, but I think overall, I think he was the right pick for doing the Atlanta storyline overall, dealing with, just all, the nuances, all the politics, just how dense everything was, there was definitely some scenes that I just really, really loved. Back in, I think it was episode two when Bill Tench was, interviewing, the one victim. And then episode five, I feel like a lot of people are going to be talking about episode five just because of the Manson. I personally really enjoyed it. And, the actor who played it, Manson, was top-notch. Kind of crazy, but, because he's portraying Manson, he's obviously just a nutter, and it was just, he did a great job. The makeup, the you know, lighting and everything was pretty good. You know, a few hiccups here and there, of course, of that. But overall, mostly across the board, along with the actors, just, you know, really high quality and, you know, fascinating story. And I think overall, like, my rating, I guess, you know, we're doing ratings now.
Yeah.
I think my rating would probably be about, let's see, 9 out of 10... airplane shots of them just traveling.
Yeah, a lot of overhead aerial shot kind of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, a lot of airplane shots where they're just like traveling back and forth to places. So
also, I gotta, it really makes me feel like I'm in the 70s because some of the color coordinating for those airplane seats and that stuff. Ooh boy.
Yeah. It was a man, dude. It was the 70s. I'm surprised they didn't have one hairstyle for every fucking woman on screen.
You know what, Alan, why don't you go? We'll save Marco for the finisher here.
Okay, definitely. So it's one of the things that I've always had a fascination with police procedurals. I've always had a fascination with serial killers because I just like the idea of solving a puzzle of a person. So I've always just kind of, and just their own weird justifications for what they're doing, why they're doing this stuff. Because serial killers are generally a branch of crime that is so unknown to us because most crime is committed because of, hey, I'm poor or I'm just in a bad situation. This situation where it's like they put themselves there because they want to. So it's like I've always found that interesting. And I finally get a show that's actually like placates to that and placates to just being very smart. Like I like how smart this fucking show is. It's doing some of the typical stuff a normal show would do when it comes to the character arc. So we have to have the character have a bad, you know, have a family issues with the wife that doesn't understand the job. But I like how they play that into every single else in the show. It's not just a random, hey, we got to cut away to get some development. It's like, no, every part of the show fits in with every other part of the show. Like, the main characters are great because you have Holden, who you think would be the most boring person in the world, and they make fun of him by making him feel like he's the most boring person in the world. But when he's in a room and he's talking to serial killers, you could tell that's where he wants to be and that's where he shines. And having them bounce off each other, again, it's like having Batman and Superman walk into a room and just solve every crime. It's fucking amazing. So I hope Netflix doesn't cancel this fucking show. I might cancel my Netflix subscription if they do that.
Man, they've been cancel happy lately, so who knows?
I'm so scared, man. I'm so scared. But, like, I hope they get a new season. I definitely want to see more of I want to see more of these characters interviewing more serial killers and just doing more, solving more crimes. I want to see where this ends up going.
All right, so what's your final rating?
I'll give this 8 out of 10 mosquito attacks.
All right, and then Mako.
All right, well, you know, I may have come across as being particularly harsh on some aspects of this season, but that's only because I love this show so much, and that first season set a very, very high standard. There's no doubt that they can't repeat the structure of season one. The story has to evolve. And so, yeah, this is very much like Mindhunter, but also something a little different. It's not my... I feel like this is more Mindhunter 1.5. Not quite 2.0 yet. Still has elements of the previous season. And those parts I particularly like. Again, I really, really wish David Fincher had done what he did last year, or the last season, which he directed the opening and closing episodes. Carl Franklin does a fantastic job, but I'm just fascinated by what Fincher does and how he manages to make everything just extra creepy. So yeah, this is definitely worth watching. Not as good, in my opinion, as season one, but still fantastic. And I really hope we don't have to wait another 2 years to get season three.
Right.
Because I might just kill somebody by then. No, I think
we'll do our own Mindhunters.
There'll be some other things to keep me occupied until then. So we'll be fine. Mm-hmm. I give this 8.5 autoerotic asphyxiations to the tune of Brian Ferry's voice.
Oh, gosh.
I should have said to the sound of Brian Ferry's voice, but you get my meaning.
Oh, that the thing of things that start and end this season, just...
yeah, they're clearly, like, setting him up as, like, the fucking Thanos of the show.
Which, by the way, if you read that first couple of John Douglas books, when he was talking about all these guys that he interviewed, BTK was still out there, and he had kind of had the profile. And you get a sense that this was John Douglas's white whale for a while.
Yeah,
yeah, he truly was the Thanos of John Douglas's life.
It's just gonna end like halfway through season three. It's just gonna be like, and if we go against the psychological profiles, it's like courting death, and he just smiles to the camera.
I am inevitable.
Yes. And I am a profiler.
He's unstoppable unless you're a Xerox machine, because copier machines disable him. He can't beat
printer
a copier.
Printer machines are terrible, no matter what generation you're in.
Can't clear a copy jam. That's his weakness.
What's he going to do, walk in a room full of printers? Oh, shit. Do I give up?
I can't handle this situation.
Okay, I think that's good right there to cut, so.
Yep.
Okay, I guess I should give a rating on my own. So, based on the 5 episodes of this that I watched, I can't accurately rate this myself, but I did enjoy what I saw. I think it's, again, the biggest strength of this show is just how good the actual acting is in this. Like, the actors in the scene just talking to each other, they all have a great chemistry, they all have a great focus. So, I guess just my initial impressions, I'd give this 8.5 out of 10 terrible pronunciations of complicated words. That dude, every time he spoke, there was just some other new way to pronounce a word. I'm just like, I'm sorry, what?
I know 7 languages.
And clearly English isn't one of them.
I'm not half, I'm full-witted.
Do you know 7 languages? Or do you know the names of 7 languages?